No. She's in Vancouver.
Oh, I see.
Was she here last time?
She was here last time.
Yes, she was.
Yeah, I've seen her both times. Never been here then.
Take Emils. Take anyone, but... We put name tags around the table. If you can find yours, Well, now that the fan has been shut off, could I invite you again to take your seats? Well, my name's Tom Berger, and let me welcome you all here this morning, the members of the Round Table and others who are here today. The way we propose to proceed is this. I will take the liberty of making some opening remarks, and then I will ask each one of you to introduce yourself, and then we will ask Ralph Johnson to summarize his paper on native land and governance here in the United States and in other jurisdictions. And then we'll ask David Case to present his paper on village home rule in Alaska. And then we'll have some discussion. There is an agenda that has been circulated. It's just a draft agenda. We've found that the best way is just to get started and then to revise the agenda each day as we go along. So feel free throughout to mention at the breaks or at lunch. Feel free to mention any changes you want made in the agenda. Mention them to me or to Rosita Worrell or to David Case, because we meet each day after the round table to see if changes should be made in the way that we're proceeding. The proceedings are being videotaped by Independent Public Television and the University of Alaska Information and Telecommunications System, and they will be making television programs to be shown on Learn Alaska, and will be making a documentary as well. And they've asked me to remind you all to speak to a microphone. There are microphones nearby each seat, so I don't think that will present any difficulty. Jim Sykes is taking down everything that's said on tape. Jim is the man just putting on the earphones, and he's wearing the colorful suspenders, and he's been taping the proceedings of the commission from its commencement in February this year. Well, having disposed of those preliminaries, let me attempt to explain why I've called this meeting. The Alaska Native Review Commission has held 52 hearings in villages and towns throughout Alaska, and more than 1,000 Alaska Natives have testified at those hearings, and that has kept us traveling throughout the state now since February. And the paramount issue for those people in the bush, and for Alaska Natives who live in the urban centers as well, according to what they have told me, is whether or not they will find a way to retain the 44 million acres of land authorized to be conveyed to the Native corporations under ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. In my view, there are three principal threats to their land: corporate failure, corporate takeover, and taxation. There are others, but I happen to think those are the three principal ones. Well, at the roundtable in November last month, we had some corporation lawyers here and some Native corporate executives, and we looked at possible solutions to 1991. We considered whether or not restrictions on the sale of shares might be imposed, together with the possibility of distribution of shares to new Natives, that is, the Native children born since 1971, thereby ensuring that the corporations and the land would remain in Native hands. We also considered whether or not it would be feasible to transfer land from the corporations to some other entity. And that brought up the question, what other entity? And we looked at the land bank, we looked at non-profit corporations. In the written version of my opening remarks, it says profit corporations, but that should be non-profit corporations. We looked at cooperatives, and we looked at IRAs. And I will be dealing in my report, which I expect will be made public late next summer, I will be dealing in my report with the usefulness of each one of these ideas. But I wanted to take a longer look at IRAs and various forms of Native self-government. Now, there is a strong IRA movement emerging in Alaska. I think I may say that because I've been to all of these villages, and in many, many of them, the subject of IRAs is brought up by the people there. And IRAs have been much talked about at the hearings in the bush. And as I told Emil Noddy and his colleagues on the Governor's Task Force on State-Tribal Relations, the IRAs are not viewed by people in the villages simply as a place to park Native land, simply as a safe place to keep Native land. I think the whole idea may have come about because people were concerned, well, if the corporations are not the best place to keep our land, then what should we do with it? And of course, transferring the land from the corporations to the IRAs was suggested, and many people think that is a sound proposition. Whether or not it is something that we discussed last month, and there's no point, it seems to me, in going over all of that ground again. Likewise, it seems to me we've covered the possibilities of transferring land to cooperatives, to the land bank, and to nonprofit corporations. Just to summarize the discussion, we looked at all four of those possibilities, and none of them came out a clear winner. There were problems with each one. But in the villages, it seems to me that IRAs are not viewed simply as one other way of preserving native land, that is, one other alternative besides the land bank, cooperatives, and nonprofit corporations. They are seen by native people as native governments managing the land and passing laws regarding activities on the land, especially subsistence. In fact, it is my observation that the IRA movement, or the sovereignty movement, self-determination movement, whatever you want to call it, has arisen in response to what are seen to be the twin crises of land and subsistence. IRAs are thought of as a means of keeping the land in native hands and as a means of defending native subsistence rights in Alaska against further encroachment. We want, therefore, to look at IRAs, and by IRAs I include traditional councils. We want to look at the upside and the downside, and I hope you will all feel free to uphold them, but better still, to attack them and to attack the whole concept as we proceed. We also want to look at what is happening in the lower 48 and in other countries. We have been looking closely at ANCSA, and we have been looking at ANCSA for the whole of the year, and many of you have been looking at it for a lot longer than that. And it's a kind of bottomless pit. Once you start discussing the problems of ANCSA, you seem to generate even more problems, and it's something that that we've spent a year now reviewing in some detail. But now, it seems to me, we want to take a look at alternatives to ANCSA, because there are many complaints about ANCSA, yet let's be sure that discussion of alternatives is about real, practical alternatives, and not about alternatives that in the end may cause more problems than ANCSA itself. Having said, I don't want us to spend our time talking about the endless problems of ANCSA. Let me say that whenever you're reviewing a subject like ANCSA, there's a tendency to look at what's wrong with it. And that's perfectly natural and probably the best way to conduct a review. People come and they tell you what's wrong with it. But it is worth remembering that there are some features of ANCSA that it seems to me stand out. I was in Kuujjuaq on Monday. That's the center of the Inuit home rule government in northern Quebec, and they asked me to come and be keynote speaker at a conference they had on Monday, and wanted to know about what we were doing in Alaska. And I told them, I said, remember three things about ANCSA: it has been the means for 13 years for Alaska Natives to manage and consolidate and retain 44 million acres of land. That's a very important thing to bear in mind. Secondly, it has enabled Alaska Natives to invest in business and to become active in business. And that's, it seems to me, an important achievement. The presence it has given Native people in the business community, it seems to me, has also given them enhanced influence in the political life of Alaska, and I don't think that should be overlooked. But for Native people in other countries, it has also been important because it was a breakthrough. It meant that ever since 1971, Native people in other countries who go to the governments to talk about land claims are able to say, we're talking about real money, like Alaska, and we're talking about vast tracts of land, like they got in Alaska. Now, in those other jurisdictions, they usually go on to say, but we don't want shareholders, corporations where shares are transferable. We want to avoid the problem of the new natives. We want to make sure that subsistence lands cannot in the future be taxed. so on and so forth. But the achievements of ANCSA are worth bearing in mind. But it is the flaws in ANCSA that have led Native people here in this state to talk seriously about IRAs, and that's why we are here to look at them, the upside and the downside. What are the alternatives? What does U.S. federal Indian law offer? And we have three of the editors of Cohen on federal Indian law here at this gathering today. We have Bob Arnold, who's written the book on the Alaska Native Claims settlement. What can other countries offer? And some folks are here from other countries. And finally, is it possible to devise new arrangements for Alaska combining the advantages of ANCSA corporations and Native governments? We are not working in a vacuum, so we should bear in mind relationships between IRAs and federal, state, and local governments. Ralph Johnson is going to be laying all this before us, and David Case has prepared a paper trying IRAs on for size as vehicles of Native home rule in Alaska. Now, there's some questions for discussion that I wrote out on a piece of paper just to give you some idea of the kind of discussion I was hoping we might have. And I asked the question, is there a movement by indigenous people in Alaska in the lower 48 and in other jurisdictions to govern themselves and their land? The second question is, do IRAs work? Is it possible to keep Native land in Native hands without submitting to federal supervision? Three, what are the implications for state-tribal relations? Four, how has the issue of state-tribal relations been tackled in the lower 48 and in other jurisdictions? What is working? And what is not working? I should have said that, too, what is not working. What is possible? What is not possible? Can state chartered governments meet the objectives of indigenous self-government? Here in Alaska, have they done so in the lower 48 and in other jurisdictions? Can indigenous self-government be accommodated in the United States, in Alaska, and in other jurisdictions? And ought indigenous self-government to be accommodated in the U.S. and in Alaska and in other jurisdictions? Well, it seemed to me we should go into these things because they are linked to the way in which people in rural Alaska are looking at ANCSA. I hope that the discussion will be wide-ranging and that all of you will feel free to join in. I will act as a moderator and try to make sure that there is a kind of, I won't say order, but at least logic to the flow of the discussion. We will take a break for coffee in the morning and in the afternoon. That will come as a relief to those of you who've attended before when never did break for coffee, and there's been much complaint about that, so we intend to break this time. Well, thank you all again for coming, and perhaps we could introduce ourselves, and perhaps we could start with David Case to my right.
My name is David Case. I'm the Commission's counsel.
My name is Ralph Werner. I teach at the University of Chicago.
David Getches, currently Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Natural Resources.
Peter Jell, I work with the Canadian Inuit setting up a Nunavut government in the Northwest Territories and with the Inuit Circumpolar Conference.
I'm Bob Arnold. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Alaska Department of Natural Resources.
I'm Reed Chambers. I'm a partner of Sanoski, Chambers, Saxe, and Guido with offices both in Washington and in Anchorage. We represent Indian tribes.
I'm Frederick Harhoff from Copenhagen in Denmark, where I teach international law and European community law, and I'm also the legal advisor to the Greenland Home Rule.
I'm Larry Ashenbrenner, an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund here in Anchorage, Alaska.
I'm Rosita Wuerl, and I serve as special consultant to the commission.
I'm Tony Vasco, one of the members of the Federal State Tribal Relations who are present here at this meeting. And we'll have a public hearing tomorrow here in Anchorage.
I'm Spud Williams of the Tanoc Chiefs Conference.
Charles Wilkinson at the University of Oregon Law School, visiting this year at the University of Colorado. My specialties are American Indian law and federal public land law.
Ted Chamberlain from the University of Toronto in Canada.
My name is Mary Miller. I work at Coeric Incorporated, which is a native nonprofit in Northwest Alaska.
I'm Professor Ralph Johnson at the University of Washington in Seattle. I specialize in American Indian law, water law.
The maybe I could just say that I'm pleased that members of the governor's task force on federal state tribal relations are able to be with us. I think some have been held up by the weather, but I'm glad that you gentlemen are here. Daly Sambo is here as the representative of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and there are some folks from Canada who came because they wanted to learn from this most distinguished group of people we've assembled at the round table, and I think you'll be meeting them over the course of the next few days. There are representatives from British Columbia, from Makavik, the regional Inuit corporation in northern Quebec, and from the CBC. Well, Ralph, could we turn to you then?
Thank you, Commissioner Berger. It's a tribute to the work and the efforts and the success of the commission that we have such a distinguished and learned and experienced group of people here for this important session. It's a real pleasure to participate. This is my third roundtable, and I find that I think I learn a great deal more from these roundtables than I'm possibly able to give. At the outset, I want to give my special thanks to Charles Wilkinson and Doug Sanders, who could not be here, for ideas and critique and such, but especially to David Case, who continues to teach me so much about Alaska problems and Alaska law. I guess the one definitional thing, I think I should say at the outset, you will be pleased to know I'm not going to read my paper. It was an effort, as you probably have discerned, if you've had time to look at it, to try and bring together some movements, some ideas, some political actions, legal actions that are occurring throughout the world in relation to indigenous peoples. It's very tough to put these pieces together into some kind of a mosaic. And what I did, I hope, is a start in that direction. Anyone who reads the paper should realize that it's only a start, because there's so much going on, it's very difficult to weave it into a fabric that is really truthful and complete and so forth. One thing that is quite clear, and that is that although I tried to put events in historical perspective, there are other historical factors going on. There's the Republicans versus the Democrats, there is the states' rights versus the Federalists in the United States, the federal side in Canada. There's the Quebec question, which drives and in some sense controls the windows of opportunity that are provided by natives. I was not capable in the time available or in less than several hundred pages to paint that kind of an historical mosaic, but surely it is something that must be kept in mind by people who are realistically concerned about this subject. There is one definitional matter that I feel compelled each time I speak to this to mention, and that is the word sovereignty. The word sovereignty is by itself not very helpful. People tend to think, especially people who have not been around the field very long, they tend to think that sovereignty is either black or it's white. I mean, you either got it or you don't got it. There's nothing in between, and yet that is clearly not true. We treat of it all kinds of ways in other contexts, but when we come to Indian or Native sovereignty, we think in those absolutist terms. Sovereignty is really, in my view, nothing more than a statement of governing power. And if I say that a group of people have governing power, your next question is, well, how much? Well, that's the same question one should ask about sovereignty. You can have a lot of sovereignty, or a lot of governing power, or you can have a little bit of sovereignty, or a little governing power. The states, vis-a-vis the United States, have quite a bit of sovereignty, but they lost some in the Constitution. The cities in the lower 48 in Alaska have some aspects, attributes of sovereignty. They don't have other attributes. So I urge that as we go through this, we tend to think of sovereignty as a word that is the beginning of a discussion, not the end of the discussion. I've tried to identify in a sketchy sort of way the existing worldwide movement of indigenous peoples to gain recognition, to gain status, to assure land tenure, to get some kind of self-determination, self-governing rights. It's a movement that I found far more broad than when I started this project, and I was only able to cover the four countries. But it is very broad. It is being recognized in the international bodies, in the United Nations. It's being recognized in Latin America. Each country has its special history, which drives the particular attributes of the search for self-determination and land tenure of the different indigenous peoples. But the movement is there. The movement cannot be denied. It's expressed in so many different ways, and as I say, I've just touched on a few. I want to spend just a few moments telling you or highlighting a few items in my paper. I think that first it's important to realize that the initial policies toward Alaska Natives were created at a time of particular history of the United States toward Indians in the lower 48. There was the removal era of the 1830s to the 1840s, 50s, along in there. Then there was the reservation era from about 1850. These numbers are not precise, 1850 to 1880, 1890, somewhere along in there. But the particular period in which Alaska was acquired and the initial formation of policy toward Alaska occurred was in the most virulent, if you want to call it, assimilationist era that the United States has ever had toward Indians. There was a second assimilation era of the 1950s, but it was very short-lived and had far less impact upon the Indian population. But the Dawes Act, the Allotment Act, which broke up reservations, took about two-thirds of the lands of the Indians and got it into non-Indian hands one way or another, was a massive attack upon the communal life. It was driven by two major forces, if I can simplify this. It was driven by bona fide Christian ethics, and it was driven by bona fide capitalistic ethics. You've got to deny or destroy the heathen, pagan religions of the natives, and you've got to break up the communal kind of life, both of which may be viewed as either good or bad or moral or immoral, but in fact those two forces joined together to get Congress to enact the Dawes Act, which essentially broke up many reservations into parcels of land, individually held parcels of land. It was exactly that era in which the initial policies toward Alaska Natives were undergoing formulation. And of course the idea at that time was not to give any special recognition toward Alaska Natives, and the initial attempt was to deny that they had the same kind of attributes of the natives, the Indians in the lower 48. But by 1900, 1905, 1910, it became apparent to anyone who studied the question that there were really no significant differences between the Alaska Natives and the natives of the lower 48. And so gradually national policy switched around to recognition of Alaska Natives in the same context with the same sovereign governmental status, and I don't mean to say there's unanimity on this, but the same ideas of sovereign governmental power, sovereignty, the governing power that the natives had for themselves, was from time immemorial. It was not created by the treaty with Russia in which Alaska was purchased in 1867. The natives governed themselves from ever. And that came forward and had not been destroyed by the acquisition of Alaska from the from Russia or by any other action. Well, gradually it became recognized that that this policy was one that the policy toward Alaska Natives should comply and should conform to the policies toward Indians in the lower 48. We had the first self-determination era, which I just remarked about, the first self-determination era in the United States, which was not the same at all in Canada, as I'll comment in a moment. But that era was from the in 1934 with the enactment of the Indian Reorganization Act. I'm always reminded of the, I believe it was Robert Service who wrote the piece on "The Land God Forgot" about Alaska. I always think that this is the land that Congress forgot. They forgot it in the 1934, and so in 1936 they had to pass a special act about Alaska. We forgot that. Well, then in 1953, Public Law 280 was enacted, and they forgot Alaska again. Well, in 1958, they had to enact a special PL 280 for Alaska. Those are only symbolic, because Congress has never been that concerned with, until recently, until oil was discovered and the state land selection process got underway, had never been fundamentally concerned about Native populations in Alaska. But in the 1960s, with the advent of statehood, the land selection process, the discovery of oil, and Native litigation that may have provided a basis for Native claims to huge shares of land, produced a congressional consciousness about Alaska Native Alaska Native aspirations and claims, and then produced the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. That act has aspects of termination in it. It has aspects of continuation of Native life and Native economic welfare in it. One of the common assumptions that was extant after ANCSA was passed was that Native governments were gone, that ANCSA settled all this. Well, that isn't true, as this commission and others have now so artfully drawn out. If you look at the ANCSA itself, you find that it is a land settlement act. It did not treat of the question of governance. And of course, that's one of the fundamental questions that is now being addressed here. Now, a few comments about the movement in other countries. Australia. When you look at the question of Australian Aborigines and the land tenure question, the governance question, you find a very different history than you find in the United States. The Aboriginals of Australia largely were pushed around without recognition of either land tenure or governance rights until the Woodward Report of 1974. That report caused, along with a change in political attitude in all of Australia, really. It didn't make any difference, as it doesn't make a lot of difference in the United States whether you have a conservative or liberal regime in. The attitude toward Native people seems to be powered by general consensus ideas in the society. Anyway, the Woodward Report started such a change of consensus, and the Aboriginal Lands Rights Act of 1976 was enacted, having to do only with the Northern Territory, and it purported to assure the Aboriginals of a certain quantity of land if they could show that they had traditionally occupied that land, and gave them some control, not in the same sense of governmental control that you find on reservations in the lower 48, but it did give them some control, and still does, through Aboriginal land trusts and Aboriginal land councils, all of which are discussed more completely in my paper. In New Zealand, the Treaty of Waitangi of 1840, which was the basic starting point for Native claims to governments or land tenure, was essentially set aside by judicial decisions which said, quite different than the United States, which said that the Treaty of Waitangi is a statement of policy, it's not a document that is a legal document. It does not control the New Zealand courts. And subsequently, the attempt by the Maori to claim that they had legal rights deriving from those treaties or from that treaty were denied. Most of the land was lost to the Maori. There are small parcels of land, significant parcels, but fairly small parcels that are still owned by the Maori. Major problems, though, have arisen over the years because of the fractionated ownership. As descent and descent and descent occurred, as people died and the numbers of participants or the numbers of owners of those lands increased, it became impossible to manage them. So in recent years, in the 1960s, 1970s, attempts have been made to merge the control of those fractionated ownership so that some kind of economic usefulness could be derived from that land. And that has now resulted in a series of incorporations and a series of trusts that have been created to allow some kind of management by the Maori themselves of those lands. Canada, it's interesting, when you live south of the border, you tend to look to the east or the west. And I'm ashamed to say we look too infrequently to Canada. When I started to look seriously there, I've been teaching Indian law all these years, and I thought, well, I know quite a bit about Canadian native claims and all this. Well, I discovered there was a vast array of important materials there, and I don't know that I've done it complete justice, but in any event, I think it's fair to say that the policy in Canada until the 1970s, really, was a quite consistent policy of assimilation. It did not have the self-determination era of the 1930s that occurred in the United States. It is significant that the Royal Proclamation of 1763 did state a basic policy that you should not overrun the native population, you should not take their land by military combat or whatever. There should be negotiations. And that policy, which was also the policy in the United States, imperfectly exercised nonetheless, but still the policy, was one that did drive Canadian relations with the native population. The Indian Act of 1876 was a compilation of a variety of statutes. I guess if I were to pull out one of the highlights of that act, I would point out the fact that the provinces in Canada exercise a great deal more control over native populations than they do in the United States. Provincial law essentially controls in Canada, except where the provincial law is explicitly contrary to the Indian Act. The Indian Act itself, the Federal Act, controls if it's explicit on a question, but other than that, the control is in the provinces, and in a de facto way, that means a great deal more control in the provinces than in the states in the United States. Also, since 1951, a province cannot enact a law that is in violation of a treaty, of a particular treaty provision. There are far fewer treaty provisions and treaties in Canada, incidentally, than there are in the United States. Well, that assimilationist policy drove Canadian policy until 1969 or 1970, a series of events, cultural attitudes, consensus ideas changed. In 1973, the Calder decision, of which Justice Berger was counsel for on the natives in that litigation, was decided, and for the first time the Canadian court system recognized to some degree in a split decision Aboriginal rights to land. Well, that was part of the shift over, part of the change that was occurring in Canadian policy. Incidentally, there were treaties signed between the Canadian government and the native population until 1956. In the United States, treaties were not signed with native populations after 1871. We had agreements and other things, legislation, but no treaties were signed after 1871. Now, the Northern Territories, I guess I'd like to cover two agreements and then talk generally about Canada's policy toward out of the national parliament. The Northern Territories agreements. Now, the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement of 1975 was an expression of the changed Canadian policy and of the international movement by Indigenous peoples to gain greater self-determination, involving the Cree and the Inuit bands of natives in Northern Canada. It's a very complex agreement. You would find that it's pages and pages and pages long. This is not a simple little document, a boilerplate treaty. This has been a carefully crafted, hard-fought, worked out document drawing upon a broad range of aspirations of all sides. Basically, it says that the land near the villages where the Cree and the Inuit live shall be forever, that's the idea, in the ownership of the native population. The minerals, as is true in Canada generally on Crown lands, is held by the Crown, by the federal government, but is under some control. There is some control on royalties and how the development should be made by the native population. Hunting and fishing rights are much more extensive than the lands that occur just around the villages. They are in far broader areas. Corporations were set up, but the corporations are not like the corporations in Alaska, which own the land as well as a business side. These corporations are basically designed to do business, and the land itself is held in a different ownership, so it will not be lost to the native population. A regional government was created for the Inuit in northern Quebec, which Commissioner Berger was just there, can tell us more about. But that government is largely controlled by the Inuit, but primarily not because of a special thing that says only Inuit can be members, but because the Inuit are the dominant population of the area. It's a very interesting structure that was set up. The other settlement that I would refer to is the Cope Settlement, ratified in 1984, just this year. Again, a carefully negotiated arrangement between the native population, Inuvialuit, I'm not sure I say it correctly, and various other entities, the federal government, the provincial or the territorial government, and so forth. And the land conveyed to the native population cannot be conveyed away. Again, it's not like the regional corporations, which may lose their land by conveying it away or by a corporate takeover or whatever. It cannot be lost to the native population. There is a complex corporate business structure, but it is considered a business structure, not one that can wipe out the assets of the community. The native population has substantial control over game management, but not exclusive control. It's a carefully arranged setup where the native population has some greater control over areas of its own vital interest and less control over areas where it's not of its keen and vital interest. Game councils, consultancies, and so forth. Again, the thing, without going into the detail of the thing that becomes apparent here, was there was an intention to sit down with the native population and negotiate. Say, where are your critical interests? Where are your vital interests and where are our vital interests? Let's try and work this out in a negotiated pattern. It seems to me that's the message that comes through in those two situations. Now, at the national level, I think that if one went back, and I think there's an important lesson in this for the work of this commission, if one went back in Canadian history 10 years, and ask the native population or any of the advocates of their views, would the new Constitution Act of 19, the Constitution, essentially amendment of 1982, contain a clause protecting native lands or governing rights? You would say it's ridiculous. Nobody's going to do that. And yet that is exactly what happened. And in 1982, in the Constitution Act of 1982, the Constitution Act recognized Aboriginal rights and treaty rights. It did not define the nature of those rights, but it did create a process by which the definition would come in constitutional conferences to be held as they were held in 1983, 1984, and others yet to be held. As a part of this ongoing process, in response to a widespread view that there ought to be negotiations, there ought to be a new pattern of relationship with the natives, the Penner Report came out in 1983, strongly affirmed the notion of bilateral arrangements, of reviving the idea of treaty negotiations with the native population. There's nothing that bars those negotiations in Canada. And then as a product of that, or as a response to that, government came out in Canada with the Indian Self-Government Act of 1983, Bill C-52, which went, I guess one would have to say, it went farther than anyone could possibly have expected toward recognizing native self-government 10 years ago. It did not go nearly as far as the Penner Report had urged and did not accept, at least has not so far, it's still in draft form, but has not so far fully accepted the concept of negotiation, but it has gone a long ways in that direction. Now I'd like to turn for just a few minutes to the alternative section of my paper, and you can see that I'm not going to dwell in great detail on a lot of the in-between stuff. But I'd like to focus our attention for a few minutes on the alternatives and suggest that this is only a partial list of what can and should be considered by the group here today. I looked at four what I called process alternatives. One can consider litigation. It's a lengthy process, uncertain results. It produces a decision at a given point in time, but does not have the capacity to consider a complex negotiation arrangement as we found in the Cope settlement and the other settlements in Canada. We have legislation as a process that can be considered. That would either be state legislation or federal legislation in the United States. I want to pause there for a moment because I have not touched on this before, but I did have a section in the paper on the takings clause and the issue of whether the Congress of the United States could enact a law which would either place the village, for example, village corporation-owned land back into a trust status, and whether that could be done constitutionally. And I think that I've established with, at least I'm satisfied, I've had others read this, without